Lost Highways from History Colorado is made possible by the Sturm Family Foundation, proud supporters of the humanities and the power of storytelling for more than 20 years.
And by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.
A note of caution to our listeners. This episode contains graphic discussions and descriptions of racial terror and violence.
I can't tell you how long I've known about it or when I heard about it, but I do know it just broke my heart to hear about it. And the sad part is that there have been other incidents in Colorado that aren't necessarily registered as lynching or anything like that, but a lot of dark stories that family members and people have talked about growing up, you know, so nothing official. But it horrified me. It didn't surprise me, but it horrified me to hear how bad that was. Our lives have been in danger all over the place anyway, so it's a sad commentary about humanity, unfortunately.
I call this poem To Preston. Sometimes I wonder, at what age do we know our songs? At what time do our bodies become our melodies, our cadences, our chords? I can still hear my grandma humming a ditty into a meal, and I wonder what your father is saying, Preston, to trick you and your brother's hunger into bedtime, to trick the house into cradling itself to sleep. Yeah, sometimes I wonder. I wonder if we all have the same fascinations of fire. Lord knows you must not. The act of putting a fresh log into the stove and watching the house cradle itself to sleep. Do you ever wonder where embers go? Have you imagined their return to the sun? I hope you did, Preston. Because a star ain't nothing but a fire.
From History Colorado Studios, this is Lost Highways, dispatches from the shadows of the Rocky Mountains. I'm Tyler Hill.
And I'm Noel Black. On this episode of Lost Highways, the lynching of Preston Porter Jr.
Though few people think of racially motivated lynchings happening in the American West, we'll look back at the history of these unlawful executions in Colorado, and one particularly horrific incident that took place in Lyman on the Eastern Plains in 1900.
Black people who came to states like Colorado seeking freedom and opportunity in the decades after the Civil War often found the same racist attitudes, prejudice, and violence they'd experienced in the South also awaited them in the West.
We'll look at the way that so-called frontier justice, popularized by dime novels and Hollywood westerns, often became a cover for racially motivated extrajudicial killings.
Finally, we'll look at the way the act of community remembrance is often the most powerful form of justice for the victims of racially motivated lynchings.
Javon Mays, the former poet laureate of Aurora and a member of the Colorado Lynching Memorial Project, will help us tell this story with excerpts from his poem, For Preston.
You know, I've gathered lumber for long winters, and I know you know such work. How to get into a log hurling rhythm, how to trick up the speed to stack fast. They call a full truck bed of firewood a cord, and four full cords should get you through the winter. But there goes those cords again. Did you get to know your song, Preston?
I knew about the lynchings in Colorado, and while I had not written about this one in particular, I knew then and know now that Colorado was not exempt.
This is Rosemary Lytle, president of the NAACP in Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana. She's also a journalist and worked for the Gazette in Colorado Springs for many years.
So the history was not new to me. What I felt in the exploration of it and the immersion of it in trying to establish a memorial to it and trying to talk to other people about it and why it was important and why it must not just be talked about, but why it must be taught, how there must be a monument to stand, not to the egregiousness of this world necessarily, but to the realities of it. And this is a part of the history of America and of this state.
Professor Stephen Leonard of Metropolitan State University in Denver also felt that this history needed to be told and taught. And in 2002, he wrote the book Lynching in Colorado, 1859 to 1919.
I chose those dates because the first lynching that we have a record of that was clearly a lynching took place in 1859, and the last that we have a record of took place in 1919. And in that period of time, there were about 175 reported lynchings. There may be more, some undoubtedly went unreported.
Leonard got interested in the history of lynchings in the West, in part to shine light on the fact that lynching wasn't just a Southern problem.
I think it's important to get a definition of lynching before we begin to talk about it. Generally, scholars have taken the view that lynching occurs when a group acting on the pretext of service to justice, tradition, or white supremacy, for example, kills another person without due process of law, such as a proper jury trial before an official court.
Many people also think that lynchings are just hangings.
They've got, I guess, Western movie versions of lynchings in their minds or ideas that somehow they picked up. But it doesn't matter how a person is unjustly killed, if they're shot, and many were shot, many were hanged, some were beaten to death, and other means were used to lynch people. So it's not the method of killing, it's just the fact of an unjust killing done by a group.
Not only did lynchings happen in the West during the time period he studied, says Leonard, but they happened in ways that we don't often think of, and in the context of racial terror.
By far, the large majority of Southern lynchings were lynchings of Black people. In the West, that wasn't the case to the same degree, at least in part because the Black population in the West was considerably smaller than in the South. The normal situation in the West was that it was white people lynching other white people, or in many cases, lynching Hispanic people, especially in Texas and California, but also in Colorado.
But that changed around the turn of the century.
By 1900, the lynchings in Colorado had become increasingly ethnically motivated.
Just as it was in the South, lynchings in the West were often made into horrific spectacles meant to terrorize people of color.
For example, in La Honda in 1902, a man named Washington Wallace was lynched, and he was in the courthouse being held in jail. And a mob of 4,000 besieged this courthouse, broke every window in the building, and knocked, battered in the door with a telegraph pole in order to get him out. And then they hanged him and then shot him. And so that was very much of a spectacle that they were engaged in.
As horrifying as Washington Wallace's lynching was, it was the lynching of Preston Porter in 1900 that caught the attention of two racial justice activists who both read Leonard's book in 2018.
Judy Ullman is a Denver-based activist who does volunteer work in Colorado prisons with the Peace Education Program.
I started wondering about lynching in Colorado, and that's when I found Stephen Leonard's book, Professor Leonard, Lynching in Colorado, 1859 to 1919. And that's when I read about Preston Porter.
And here's Anthony Suggs, who also discovered the book around the same time.
I was working for the Episcopal Church in Colorado as the missioner for advocacy and social justice. So in that role, one of the main focus areas was racial justice. And to do that a little bit better, I wanted to get to know the landscape of racial justice in Colorado, which led me to research if there had been any lynchings in Colorado. So I did some research and found out about Preston's story and was really horrified by it and wanted to learn more.
When Stephen Leonard's book brought Suggs and Ullman together, Colorado was on the verge of becoming one of the first states in the country to pass a constitutional amendment that would formally abolish all slavery.
To this day, incarcerated people can be treated as slaves under the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And in 2018, Colorado passed an amendment to remove similar language from the state constitution.
With the push to abolish slavery in Colorado in full swing, Suggs and Ullman both felt the time was right to remember Preston and tell his story. Terry Gentry is a community historian, volunteer docent, and sits on the board of directors of the Black American West Museum.
She says Preston Porter's story begins with the end of the Mexican-American War and the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. It granted the land that would become Texas, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Kansas, and Colorado to the United States.
The United States bought all of this land for about $15 million, and then California became a free state when the decisions were being made about how they were going to handle territories. The territories could determine whether or not they were going to be a free state or a slave state. So that's a lot of, there was a whole lot of stuff going on about free states and slave states and what was going to happen in the West. And some of that fueled the Civil War.
For many enslaved Black people, the West and the new territories created by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo represented the possibility of a new beginning in America and freedom from the long, brutal history of slavery in the South.
So when you live a life enslaved and you're running from the brutality and the viciousness and the fear and horrific conditions, there's so much possibility in the unknown, going out and making your own life and creating a way of living for your family and getting away from the horrible experiences you have. I could imagine myself that I'm thinking, I've got nothing to lose. Let's go see what we can create. We don't know what we're going to face, but it can't be any worse than what we've been through. I'm sure it's going to be better. And so there were a lot of possibilities.
It was in this context that Black migrants known as exodusters came west, often as homesteaders, willing to risk everything for the chance at a fresh start.
Some started all-Black settlements like Nicodemus, Kansas, and later Deerfield, which we covered in season one of Lost Highways.
But just because they escaped the South and found land or work in free states after the Emancipation Proclamation didn't mean they'd escape the culture of slavery in the U.S. and the many prejudices that fueled it.
We had a lot of folks in Colorado that didn't want to see us here. They sure had the same attitude and perspective on making sure that they kept us in our place.
After Reconstruction fell short of the hope some had for a more equal and equitable United States, Jim Crow, along with other laws and prohibitions, made sure formerly enslaved Black people were kept at the lowest rung of the social ladder in every facet of public life, more often than not, leaving them free in name only.
There were so many egregious laws and policies put in place around the country during the Reconstruction era to pull us back as close to slavery without calling it that, so they could continue to use our labor for free or continue to make profits off of our backs and continue to keep us contained, still having to have a pass to move from one place to another. When the voting was put in place, having poll taxes, having tests to take to vote, and all of these policies and procedures to continue to keep us contained, keep us restricted, and to take away and chisel away at any little bitty rights that we might have acquired through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the Civil Rights Act of 1866.
Gentry says that lynchings became increasingly common during this time between the late 1870s and early 1900s.
By the time Reconstruction ended, the violence, lynchings, murders, taking away land, burning down homes, causing people to run for their very lives, the destruction of these very lives was in full effect. And there are a few families that I know that had family members in one part of the South, and they had to pack up in the middle of the night and leave because somebody stood up to a white man and said no about something, or asked for pay for something that they did, and they offended the white man because they asked for pay. So come home and say, we're going to have to pack up and leave. And they pack up their stuff and leave in the middle of the night because they know if they're there the next morning, somebody's going to be murdered.
For many black men, the safest place to be was in no one place for very long.
Construction had begun on the Transcontinental Railroad in Council Bluffs, Iowa in 1863, shortly after the start of the Civil War. And by 1869, it reached all the way to San Francisco in a single, near 2,000-mile-long stretch of continuous track.
And as train travel opened the West to miners, settlers, and tourists in the decades that followed, black men found work and a home of sorts on the trains.
George Pullman started the sleeping cars back in probably around 1867 or so, and specifically hired black men to service the sleeping cars on the train.
They were safer on board the trains in some ways, and they had steady work. The Pullman Company was, in the late 19th century, the second largest employer of black men in the country.
But there was a price to pay.
He wanted them to wear the demeanor they had to wear during slavery. He wanted that ideology on the trains.
And the white passengers treated them accordingly.
There was always an expectation of the behavior that the black men had to portray on the trains, but at the same time, they were invisible and not necessarily treated with dignity and respect. There was just, boy, you better get my luggage, or boy, you know, that kind of stuff.
On top of that, there were seldom even basic accommodations for black workers.
When the black men serviced the sleeping car trains, they didn't have any facilities on the train to sleep or take care of themselves. Sometimes they were having to sleep for a few hours in the dining cars. Some, depends on where you are, sometimes they had to wait till the train pulled into a station that they could get off the train and go use the colored restroom. There were so many things that they had to confront on the trains with what they were allowed and not allowed to do.
Long before the Supreme Court ruled that so-called separate but equal Jim Crow laws were constitutional, in the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896, black people were treated as an underclass.
You had to disconnect who you are from what you did so that it wouldn't tear your heart out of your chest.
Some of the men who worked the railroads also did other jobs, like track maintenance and filling coal tenders, that required less degrading performance for white people.
So the Pullman porters and waiters were the primary, the largest number of folks on the trains, but you had all these support systems around the trains, a lot of other jobs that were done in support of the train system because it was the most important transportation system we had back in the day.
Because there were so many black men working on the trains, many of their families would make their homes in cities along the line.
Mostly they'd settle in places like Denver, where there was relative safety in numbers.
We had quite a few black families move into Colorado the latter part of the 19th century and then a real explosion after the turn of the century. So the Porter family, that they were part of that experience, they moved from Kansas to Colorado.
Like so many other black men at the time, Preston Porter Sr., his eldest Arthur, and his 15-year-old son Preston Porter Jr. took the train west.
And in mid-November 1900, they got off in Lyman, Colorado to do work on a branch line for the Union Pacific.
They say in music, a chord is a harmony of three notes. And I think about you, signing the pages of the Gospel of Luke, tearing them out and handing them to your future executioners. One, two, three. And how they use those as invitations to your concert.
Over the next few minutes, social justice advocate Judy Ullman, her daughter Dara Ullman, Professor Stephen Leonard, Episcopal missioner Anthony Suggs, and historian Terry Gentry will tell the story of Preston Porter's lynching.
Again, this story is extremely disturbing.
Preston and his brother and father were in Colorado to work on the railroad. They actually lived in Kansas. So they were here temporarily working on the railroad in the Lyman vicinity. and there was a brutal rape and murder of a girl. Some accounts say she was 12, some accounts say she was 13.
And there was a girl in the vicinity named Louise Frost who was murdered. You know, the accusation was that she was raped. A lot of the farmers around that area were very much enraged by her death.
But right off the bat, there are newspaper accounts that say this must have been committed by a black man. And so the only people that they questioned in relation to that crime were black and brown people.
They never did an investigation to find out who killed her. They just decided since this black man happened to be in town working on the railroads that that's the only answer to the fact that this little white girl was killed.
Preston, his father, his brother were picked up in Denver. I think they were in Denver to cash their check at the Union Pacific. This is all documented in the newspaper.
So they arrested, from what I understand, they arrested the dad and his two sons and beat them and brutalized them mercilessly.
So after they were arrested, Preston was held in a sweatbox. He was tortured. He was basically a confession was coerced from him.
They kept him in a sweatbox and basically they threatened that if he didn't confess to this sexual assault and murder of this child, that they would lynch or they would kill his brother and his father.
So, you know, you put you dehydrate people, which they did by putting them in a sweat box, which, you know, not giving enough water. And you do that for a long period of time. And then you threaten somebody with their brother or their father being lynched also or being charged with murder. And you you have a horrible situation where somebody is very likely going to confess just to not have other people in the family suffer.
So he confessed, and but he was asked about his confession. And when he was asked about it, he said, "I confessed in order to save my father and my brother." But of course, as soon as he confessed, that then they didn't need to prove anything because they had no direct evidence linking him to the crime. But once he confessed, they sort of didn't need that. And so that's when the calls for his lynching started.
Once they had his alleged confession, a mob of at least 1,000 people gathered outside the jail in Denver, and Preston was quickly moved to the Arapahoe County Jail in secret.
Since the crime had been committed in Lyman, Sheriff Freeman made arrangements to take him back to Hugo, the county seat, just 15 miles beyond Lyman.
But many, including Colorado Governor Charles Thomas, a former Confederate soldier, believed that Preston would be lynched and didn't try to stop it.
Newspapers like the Denver Evening Post all but called for Preston's lynching on their front pages after reporting the details of Preston's confession that would undoubtedly have seemed like proof of his guilt.
Headlines like "Wild Mob at Lyman Impatient for Blood of Porter" on the front page made the lynching seem virtually inevitable.
And like so many other lynching victims, Porter's guilt was presumed by many even before his confession, because he was a young black person, not even 16 years old, and the victim was a white girl.
Despite inconsistencies in his confession and irregularities with the evidence against him, news of his admitted guilt in the papers sealed his fate.
But of course, he never made it to Hugo. He was taken off the train by a mob, an angry white mob, at Lake Station, which is just outside of Lyman.
According to the Denver Evening Post, 12 men boarded the train, subdued the sheriff, and led Porter off the train with a noose around his neck.
It's doubtful that Sheriff Freeman had any real intention of resisting the mob that awaited Preston and Lyman, even if he could have. Sheriffs are typically elected officials, and he would have known that any attempt to prevent Porter's lynching in Lyman might have put his career on the line, if not his life.
And then he was taken a short distance. They wanted to have him burned at the stake at the site of the crime.
I think they wanted a spectacle, pretty obviously, or they felt that they had to, you know, teach a lesson of some sort.
And then actually they waited because they wanted, people were coming, you know, to view the lynching, because it's what's known as a spectacle lynching, which is where, you know, crowds gather. And so they waited for trains to come from Colorado Springs and from Denver.
Until the crowd reached over 300 people.
The Los Angeles Herald reported the crowd of men and boys at around 200, but counts vary. The majority, it said, came from Lyman, Hugo, and surrounding farms and ranches.
And so I think he waited as long as 2 hours before they actually, started the fire.
And it was only then that he was chained to this railroad tie and lit on fire.
Your solo on that stake, your terror on that tie, the cadence of your chains, the choral of your kerosene, accenting a symphony of splinters as your throat became their justice. Do you think they heard you, Preston? Did they register the register of your wails, your weeping? Did they, Preston? Did they hear your family in your lungs as you went from kin to kindling? Did they see your human as your skin molted? Did they catch the signals in your smoke?
A telegraph had been set up near the site of the lynching for reporters, and the Los Angeles Herald published one of the most harrowing accounts of Porter's death on November 17, 1900, the day after.
Among many other horrific details that we won't recount here, the article reports on a variety of seemingly mundane details that reveal the terrifying consequences of mob logic.
The effort to put together this type of thing is what made its sinister nature stand out to me. I just couldn't imagine the day-long process to put together this death spectacle, to invite people, to give them the time to travel by train to get to you don't even go to Lyman just be doing nothing. You don't go to Lyman for anything. So the concept that somebody would be going there for this, and thinking about a statewide effort to be in participation with this, to think about fetching this individual back in the city of Denver, there's just a lot. It felt like a whole bunch of people going as far out of their way as they possibly could to make this happen. And I think that's what really stood out to me the most when I first started learning about this is that effort piece was really alarming to me to think about that.
Professor Stephen Leonard, who was also part of the Colorado Lynching Memorial Project, says he's always shocked by mob logic and violence, whether it's Preston Porter's lynching or the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021.
It's psychologically somewhat hard for us to grasp, but then again, we've been through it in the last year or so, that when mobs get going, they manage to convince themselves of the righteousness of their position, and they become beasts, and they stop, if their mental processes as they ever had, they abandon them, and you get horrible things happening.
And it's even more troubling to Leonard that anytime someone is lynched, no one gets real justice.
Well, one of the huge problems with lynchings is that good investigations are never done. They just say, we've got our person, we've got our man or our boy, and case closed. And so we'll never know. That's very, very sad because the victims deserve justice also.
Like Javon Mays, Anthony Suggs was similarly affected by the small details in the Los Angeles Herald's account of the macabre fanfare in the hours leading up to the spectacle of Preston's death.
It was a common practice for people to try to get souvenirs at lynchings. And in this case, the souvenirs happened to be pages out of Preston's Bible that he signed and tore out and distributed.
Then, once the crowd had gathered and Preston was done giving out autographed pages of his Bible, he was chained to a railroad tie set upright in the ground. A pile of wood and kindling beneath his feet was doused in kerosene and lit on fire by Louise Frost's father.
For Anthony Suggs as a Christian, the parallels between Preston's lynching and the crucifixion of Jesus are impossible to ignore.
There's accounts of him actually reading the Gospel of Luke as he was waiting to be killed. You know, one of the sensationalized articles talks about Preston shouting, like screaming as he is burning, that asking God to forgive the people that are doing this to him.
Onlookers in the mob, the article says, laughed at Porter while he shouted Bible quotations through the flames.
The core belief of my faith is that God chose to become a human being who was then publicly executed. And that was the moment in which he showed incredible power and solidarity with the oppressed of the earth. So if that is something that my faith is built around, I need to interact with Preston's story in a little bit of a deeper way than just shock.
For activist Judy Ullman, reading the accounts of Preston's death in Stephen Leonard's book was an awakening to the fact that the West had a much more troubling history of racial injustice than she'd ever heard or read about.
I saw that lynching was common in Colorado during that time period. But that it was, you know, that phrase frontier justice, which of course is a terrible phrase because it's not justice at all. Lynching is never justice. But I had a place to put it. But Preston's outside of that because it was just so much more brutal. So that's what really made me feel like this has to be, this can't go unnoticed.
As chance would have it, Suggs and Ullman both reached out to Professor Stephen Leonard around the same time in 2018. After they read Preston's story in his book. They both wanted to know more about the history of racial terror in Colorado and the West, and Preston's story in particular.
Leonard didn't know much more about Preston's case than the brief account he'd included in his book, so he got together with Suggs and Ullman.
The three of them decided it was time for Porter's story to be more widely known.
And so then I immediately contacted EJI to see if they had a record of Preston's lynching, and they did, and so it was possible for me to volunteer to organize a remembrance for him through their community remembrance project.
EJI stands for the Equal Justice Initiative, an organization dedicated to challenging racial and economic injustice in all areas of the American legal and justice system.
It was started by a Black public interest lawyer named Brian Stevenson in 1989. He'd been working with unrepresented Black prisoners on death row in Montgomery, Alabama, and ended up dedicating his life to seeking justice for the disproportionate number of incarcerated Black men in U.S. prisons. Here's Stevenson speaking in a TED Talk he gave in March of 2012.
This country is very different today than it was 40 years ago. In 1972, there were 300,000 people in jails and prisons. Today, there are 2.3 million. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We have 7 million people on probation and parole, and mass incarceration, in my judgment, has fundamentally changed our world. In poor communities and communities of color, there is this despair, there is this hopelessness that is being shaped by these outcomes. One out of three Black men between the ages of 18 and 30 is in jail, in prison, on probation, or parole.
Judy Ullman found out about Stevenson's work when she read his best-selling 2018 memoir, Just Mercy, the same year.
I mean, his goal was to really shed light on our history. I mean, what he saw was, what he saw in the work that he did, working with inmates on death row, was first of all, that lynching had never ended. It had just moved from being outside of the justice system to being within the justice system. And then he realized we have to shed a light on our history because people aren't even aware of what lynching was like. I mean, even that it went on and just the brutality of it, that it wasn't just lynching. I mean, he coined this term racial terror lynching because it was a means to subjugate Black people.
Stevenson wanted the Equal Justice Initiative and the remembrance of lynching victims to reach far beyond the walls of the museum. And in 2018, the EJI created the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, also known as the Lynching Memorial.
Stevenson's work led him not only to seek justice for those who were in prison, but also to remember and memorialize as many Black people as possible who had been unjustly lynched in the United States.
His vision was that this memorial wouldn't just be in Montgomery, Alabama, but that it would reach into every community where a lynching had happened. which would do two things. One, it would recognize that the person that was lynched was a human being with family in a community. So it would recognize that individual person. But then it would also bring the history of that terrible act into the community where it happened, so that the community would have the chance to reckon with that, to look at their past and acknowledge it and, you know, hopefully heal from it.
Sometimes, when there's community buy-in, placards or memorial sculptures are erected to honor the victims.
But in all cases, jars of soil are collected from the sites of racial terror lynchings and sent to the lynching memorial in Alabama to join the many other jars along a wall of jars with the names of the victims.
By partnering with the Equal Justice Initiative and the lynching memorial, Ullman and Sugg saw an opportunity to bring national attention to Porter's story and the history of racial terror lynching in Colorado.
They also got in touch with Rosemary Lytle at the NAACP and began to organize a community remembrance and soil collection ceremony for Preston Porter Jr. and Lyman.
On the eastern plains of Colorado, the wind can be spellbinding. Some say it can even sweep. And Lord, how we watched them sweep you under our flagged rug, swept your remains so that you would not, but I think of a sweep, Preston. And how it can be uplifting, how it can carry you when you can't carry yourself. Oh, I know wind. Out here in these plains, they farm wind to recharge. Turn binded, they watch their houses cradle themselves to sleep. But at night, when it's just you and the moon, if you listen real deep, you can hear the wind howl.
Lyman, Colorado sits just off I-70, halfway between Denver and the Kansas border in Lincoln County. It hasn't changed a whole lot in 120 years.
In 1900, Lyman had a population of 970, and 13 black people lived in all of Lincoln County. As of the 2020 census, Lyman has only grown by a few hundred residents. There were no black people counted, 13% identified as, quote, Hispanic, 1% identified as Asian, 1% as Pacific Islander, and the remaining 85% as white.
The largest employer in town is a state prison, and few who travel past it on Interstate 70 stop for anything much more than a tank of gas just off the interchange at Highway 24.
When Rosemary Lytle, Anthony Suggs, Judy Ullman, Javon Mays, and several others formed the Colorado Lynching Memorial Project to commemorate Preston Porter Jr.'s life and remember his death, no one expected the town of Lyman to be excited or to welcome them.
Poet Javon Mays wasn't the least bit surprised when there was zero mention of Porter's lynching in the small Lyman Heritage Museum, where the committee decided to hold the remembrance in November of 2018.
What did surprise Mays was the unflinching way the committee made his presence and intentions in Lyman known, without apology.
What's interesting is to kind of see some of that initial resistance from that environment to engage in Preston's narrative. And one of the cool blessings of this project is the partnership with Equal Justice Initiative, because they're pretty frank, and they're frank in ways that I'm not even used to being frank as a Coloradan, right? When I'm going to enter an environment that is potentially racist, I know that I need to throw on, you know, I need to put pillows on my hands. I need to be very gentle in the way that I manage this environment. I need to be very observational. I need to keep my cards close to my chest. I need to be welcoming and all these other things. And to see some of those folks be pretty frank and being like, we're going to have this event here. You can help us run this event, or you can't. Here's what some of the environments who like didn't help with what kind of looked like afterwards. So I suggest that you help. And then like watching folks kind of concede.
The unapologetic reclaiming of space in Lyman, demanding that the community own its history, was an important way for the committee to honor Preston, says Anthony Suggs.
He credits this bold approach to Rosemary Lytle of the NAACP and Reverend Tawana Davis, one of the co-founders of Soul to Soul Sisters, an organization with a, quote, Black women-led, faith-based response to anti-Black violence.
I remember the morning that we met to sort of memorialize the fact that this whole day began in Denver, where Preston was held at the Old City Jail. Tawana reminded us all that Preston, you know, screaming for God to forgive the people that were doing this to him was not this sort of subservient, you know, all patient blackness that I think a lot of white people are more comfortable with, you know, a blackness that is quick to forgive and doesn't want justice. But Tawana reminded us that that was Preston really claiming his solidarity with Jesus and Jesus's experience of being killed publicly and taking on that power to say, even though you're doing this to me right now, you have no power over me. That was him taking on his power the only way he could in that moment.
Though the exact location of his lynching is no longer known, in October of 2020, there was a small soil gathering ceremony along the train tracks near where Preston died.
Then, a month later, a day after the 118th anniversary of his lynching, a group of close to 100 people gathered at the Lyman Heritage Center to remember him and reflect on the ongoing significance of his death.
The soil that had been collected near the train tracks sat in a bowl on the center of a table at the front of the room in between two glass jars as the various committee members spoke.
Here's Rosemary Lytle at the ceremony.
We cannot mourn and memorialize Preston Porter Jr., but fail to mourn and memorialize Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Jordan Davis, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, Philando Castile. When we say his name, we must say their names. Say their names. Racism, hate, white supremacy, white fragility, white jealousy, all of those things remain threats that hang over all Black people even today. Even those with money, with education, with titles, with positions, and those without, can be killed by the police for any reason.
And Anthony Suggs.
We all have a part to play in this. We all fit into the story somehow. And I encourage everyone to think about where you fit in as we all come forward to put our piece into the jars.
After everyone spoke, attendees were invited to come forward and move a handful of soil from the bowl to each of the two jars.
And they say that wolves wail to the sky to call in the pack. And if this is true, then what else is a howl but a song? Calling us in to a choir of chords, bottled in confession and confusion, teenaged and tormented, wondering if it was ever heard, and somewhere, under all that brimstone, under all that char, in that Holocaust combustion was a song, constructed by a Preston Porter Jr. We learn your chords every time we hear the wind howl on the eastern plains, calling us in, reminding us that we have some songs to teach.
Javon Mays, who read this poem for Preston at the ceremony, was struck by the way the event echoed the history in healing ways.
But then us getting there and not expecting the audience, again, it's almost, I've never actually thought about this, but it's almost like Preston's, you know, death moment replayed in this really cool, unique way because people came from all over the state to be at this moment.
Bringing Porter's memory back into that space and back into the history of the community that collectively took his life was a crucial part of what the ceremony was meant to do.
When the history of Lyman, Colorado is told, they have to tell it now with him. Quite frankly, I don't know, but I imagine if you Google Lyman, Preston might be the first thing that comes up, right? That you got to take, you can't just scrape folks, put them aside, and just don't expect, you know, when you dismiss their return, they're here, and they're present. And that's what history is supposed to do, you know?
For Anthony Suggs and other members of the Colorado Lynching Memorial Project, remembering Preston isn't just about Lyman, and certainly isn't about punishing Lyman for its history.
It's all about Colorado, and about the West reckoning with its history of racial terror and lynching.
I think most folks get the sense that Colorado is this, you know, very egalitarian, Western, progressive state for the most part. So when you're confronted with what I think is one of the most horrific lynchings in American history, it can really shock and challenge your view of a state, whether you've lived here for a year or lived here your whole life. So I think a lot of folks have a really strong reaction to this when they first hear about it, mostly of shock, sometimes of sorrow, sometimes discomfort. I don't want to engage with this anymore, or a discomfort that leads folks like Judy and myself to want to engage with it even more.
Professor Stephen Leonard says that so-called frontier justice is especially damaging because it perpetuates the myth that there was no legal system to handle criminal charges.
You had to tame the West. You had to deal with these bad guys. And if you dealt with it quickly, that's just fine, because it was the, you know, otherwise the poor little settlers would have been preyed upon. Well, you know, courts were functioning after 1861. Anybody could have been legally tried. I mean, that it's just silly to take the position that somehow we were doing a good thing.
And this extrajudicial way of handling things was often validated by leading intellectual supporters of westward expansion.
The historian Frederick Jackson Turner wrote admiringly of the no-nonsense approach of the frontier backwoodsman, intolerant, quote, intolerant of men who split hairs or scrupled over the method of reaching the right.
Black people, American Indians, and people of Mexican heritage and descent were all inconvenient reminders that the settlement and development of the United States came at their expense in ways that Americans are still struggling to reckon with.
Giving them due process would mean acknowledging their equality, not just as citizens, but as humans.
Javon Mays says the work it takes to confront painful history isn't supposed to be easy.
When you're doing this work, you know that there's going to be resistance. If there wasn't, they would have already done the work, right? You know what I mean? So you know that you're going to encounter some kind of resistance. You don't know what it is, and I don't think it's fair to assume you know what it is, right?
But Anthony Suggs says that until we see our history and all the pain it caused, we can't heal and we can't move forward.
I think for the most part, we are scared to even begin that process because there is so much to unpack. Like even if we were just looking at Colorado, you would have to unpack the genocide of Native peoples. You would have to unpack, well, the genocide of Native peoples and cultural genocide of both the Spanish colonial system and the American colonial system. You would have to unpack the violence against Mexican Americans in Colorado. You'd have to unpack violence against Chinese Americans in Colorado. The forced internment of Japanese Americans in Colorado, and the reality of lynching, redlining, segregation, all of it. And that's just Colorado.
The outpouring of rage, grief, sadness, and frustration that flooded the streets after the deaths of George Floyd and, more locally, Elijah McClain in the summer of 2020 is just one example of how much of that work we still have to do.
Rosemary Lytle.
Some people, at least, don't think about lynching when they think about an official knee on your neck for 9 minutes, or when they think about being stopped in the middle of a road on your way to your first job and ending up dead, supposedly committing suicide in some Texas jail. They don't really think about lynching when they think about Breonna Taylor. But we know that lynching comes in its most obvious forms and comes in other forms. But the bottom line is that the assaults on Black bodies are historic and egregious. And at this point, we've seen enough and we know enough We've witnessed enough, if we have our eyes and hearts open, to know why lynching, maybe in the American consciousness, began with Emmett Till, but didn't end there and still hasn't.
But Javon Mays says we need to step beyond the ideological lines on the sand and actually take a look at the whole truth of who we are as a nation.
You know, I think a big part of some of this is just understanding that it's possible, like in our own histories, in all of our histories, that evil can take place. And that if we're complacent, like, evil can run wild. When we're talking about Preston Porter, when we're talking about a Japanese internment camp, when we're talking about hundreds of people slain in Sand Creek. And that's what these events are. This is evil running wild.
Terry Gentry says that addressing these evils must be done systemically. And she doesn't know if we'll ever fully move forward as a country until we talk about what she sees as the common thread that ties together everything from chattel slavery to mass incarceration, economic inequality, and even the climate crisis.
One of the challenges is that it took 4 billion years to form the planet and all of these things. It's taken 500 years to destroy it. And when you look at everything that's happening on the planet, the umbrella is capitalism. And then dropping out of the umbrella are all of these other things that feed capitalism. I don't know how you change that. I don't know. Because it's been a work in progress for 150 years or more, and we're still fighting the same issues that we fought when slavery ended. And the fact of the matter is slavery hasn't ended when you look at all of these different institutions that still perpetuate it. I don't know how you change it. I don't know. I hope we can. The hope is always there. I will never stop hoping, and I will never stop praying for that change to happen. But it's pretty bleak.
Sometimes I wonder, at what age do we know our songs? At what time do our bodies become our melodies, our cadences, our chords? I can still hear my grandma humming a ditty into a meal. And I wonder what your father is saying, Preston, to trick you and your brother's hunger into bedtime, to trick the house into cradling itself to sleep. Yeah, sometimes I wonder. I wonder if we all have the same fascinations of fire. Lord knows you must not. The act of putting a fresh log into the stove and watching the house cradle itself to sleep. Do you ever wonder where embers go? Have you imagined their return to the sun? I hope you did, Preston, because a star ain't nothing but a fire. You know, I've gathered lumber for long winters, and I know you know such work. How to get into a log hurling rhythm. How to trick up the speed to stack fast. They call a full truck bed of firewood a cord. And 4 full cords should get you through the winter. But there goes those cords again. Did you get to know your song, Preston? They say in music a chord is a harmony of 3 notes. And I think about you, signing the pages of the Gospel of Luke, tearing them out, and handing them to your future executioners. 1, 2, 3. And how they use those as invitations to your concert. Your solo on that stake. The terror on that tie. The cadence of your chains. The choral of your kerosene. Accenting a symphony of splinters as your throat became their justice. Do you think they heard you, Preston? Did they register the register of your wails, your weeping? Did they, Preston? Did they hear your family in your lungs as you went from kin to kindling? Did they see your human as your skin molted? Did they catch the signals in your smoke? On the eastern plains of Colorado, the wind can be spellbinding. Some say it can even sweep. And Lord, how we watch them sweep you under our flagged rug, swept your remains so that you would not, but I think of a sweet Preston, and how it can be uplifting, how it can carry you when you can't carry yourself. Oh, I know wind.
out here in these plains, they farm wind to recharge. Turn-binded, they watch their houses cradle themselves to sleep. But at night, when it's just you and the moon, if you listen real deep, you can hear the wind howl. And they say that wolves wail to the sky to call in the pack. And if this is true, then what else is a howl but a song, calling us in to a choir of chords, bottled in confession and confusion, teenaged and tormented, wondering if it was ever heard, and somewhere, under all that brimstone, under all that char, in that Holocaust combustion was a song, constructed by a Preston Porter Jr. We learn your chords every time we hear the wind howl on the eastern plains, calling us in, reminding us that we have some songs to teach.
As we mentioned at the beginning, the racial violence discussed in this episode is disturbing. For more information and resources on racial trauma, please visit this season's website at historycolorado.org/losthighways. Lost Highways is a production of History Colorado and History Colorado Studios. It's made possible by a generous grant from the Sturm Family Foundation, with particular thanks to Stephen Sturm and Emily Sturm, and by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to support it, please become a member of History Colorado. You can get 20% off your membership at historycolorado.org/podcast discount. Plus, you get all kinds of great benefits like free admission to our 8 museums around the state, where you can learn more about the stories we tell on Lost Highways. You'll also get a subscription to the Colorado Magazine, which includes access to insightful articles and compelling perspectives on Colorado's past.
And even if you don't become a member, you can still get $2 off admission to any of our museums just by mentioning the podcast.
A very special thanks to Susan Schulten, our history advisor on this episode, and to Managing Editor of Publications Natasha Gardner and Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen, our story editors.
And to Ann Sneesby Cook for newspaper and periodical research.
Our assistant producer is Maria Jose Maddox, and Luke Perkins is our intern.
If you'd like to see a transcript of any of our episodes, either as a matter of accessibility or because you'd like to use Lost Highways in your classroom, you can find them at historycolorado.org/losthighways.
Tyler Hill, my co-host, composed the music for this episode. Our theme is by Connor Bergal. Many thanks to our editorial team, Jason Hansen, Sam Bach, Sean Boyd, Kimberly Cronwall, Jose Ortega, Julie Peterson, Angel V. Hill, Marisa Volpe, and Zach Workowicz.
And to our advisory group, which includes Stephen Sturm, Emily Sturm, Jason Hansen, Thomas Andrews, Jonathan Futa, Charlie Woolley, Susan Schulten, Tom Romero, and Kara DeGette.
Finally, thanks to the entire staff at History Colorado. I'm Noel Black.
And I'm Tyler Hill. Thanks for listening.